Here's where we were. Romans chapter 8. The last verses we read were verses 24 and 25, where he says, "For in this hope," and this is the hope I was talking about, the hope of the resurrection from the dead, which is a crazy thought. You know, I was driving past a cemetery the other day, and I thought, really? You know, it's just like, really? Come on. I mean, it's easy to believe in that there's a creator, you know. It's easy to believe in God. You know, sure, a divine being, spiritual stuff, that's easy to believe in because it's kind of abstract and you don't have to, but really? Physical resurrection? You know, it's a mind bender. It was too much for the Greeks, you know, and so Paul kept running into trouble with this. Even in his Corinthian congregation, you know, he had a camp sitting in the congregation that did not believe the resurrection was literal. And that's what 1 Corinthians 15 is all about. Well, from Paul, from the Jewish perspective, it's like, you know, as a Pharisee, from a Pharisaic Jewish perspective, yes, that's what it's all about. If there's no resurrection from the dead, what's the point? That's what he expresses in 1 Corinthians 15. So he says, "For in this hope of the resurrection we were saved." Now hope that is seen is not hope. For who hopes for what he sees? But if we hope for what we do not see, we wait for it with patience. And I was talking about this. This is what we're waiting for. We're waiting for the resurrection of the dead, the transformation of the entire world, and the rescue from this body of death that's ruled by sin. That we should become children of God, is the way he says. Sons of God and daughters of God. And he's going to go on with this theme. He says, "Likewise, the Spirit of God helps us in our weakness." Remember, we learned this last week too. "For we do not know what to pray for as we ought, but the Spirit of God himself intercedes for us with groanings too deep for words, as he searches hearts and knows what is the mind of the Spirit, because the Spirit intercedes for the saints according to the will of God." And I told you that's an allusion to Proverbs 20, verse 27. So that's where we left off last week. Now, we're ready to start the new material. He says, "And we know that for those who love God, all things work together for good, for those who are called according to his purpose." This is a verse that you probably have encountered a lot of times as a believer, because this is a verse that we bring out to say when stuff doesn't make sense in your life, and it seems like God was kind of checked out. And terrible things happened, and you experience pain or disappointment or whatever the case may be. Well, we know that everything works together for the good of those who love God. So even though we don't see the good, you don't see the good, you don't know the good, nevertheless, ultimately, it's for the greater good. We don't know why. I don't know. I'm not sure how comforting this is. It's a cerebral sort of comfort. You know, it doesn't really help the heart when the heart's grieving, right? Say, "Oh, that's really good too." Yeah, right. There are things that it's really hard to put into that box. But nevertheless, the sentiment is correct. It's true. It's absolutely true. You know, Hashem, how do we know it's for the good? Because Hashem's in charge of everything. Hashem is in charge of everything, and Hashem is good. Now, it might not be good for you in your immediate experience of life, but that your immediate experience of life is a very, very small piece of the greater fabric of reality. That's God's reality. He's created. So, yeah, life has its ups and downs. It has its pain, it has its... It has its joys. It has its sorrows. You know, and we could talk philosophically all night about the problem of pain. But I don't think that's what Paul's really talking about here. I think the verse is absolutely true, and to use it that way is absolutely correct, but I don't get the idea that that's exactly what Paul had in mind here, because in fact he wasn't really talking about that at all, was he? He was talking about, well, what's he talking about? Here's how I would put it. And by the way, you know who does some really nice work on this idea of... if you've read Laser Brody's stuff on Emunah, you know, maybe sometimes you might say that goes overboard. but nevertheless, the sentiments are very much in line with Romans 8, 28, all things working together. He really builds that. He builds that concept and, you know, this idea. And of course, not from the New Testament, you know, but... he builds that concept in a very beautiful way. It's just like, this is what it means to trust in God. I mean, ultimately, this is what faith, trusting Hashem, is. That you trust him in the good and the bad because he's good. Even though the bad happens. And it is bad. Nevertheless, Hashem is good. So, anyway... like I said, we could talk about that all night. What's Paul really saying here? He says, we know that for those, and here's with my interpolations, for those Jews and God-fearing Gentile believers, you know, whole thing, who love God, all the following things work together for good. This is my suggestion, that what he specifically has in mind is the following things he's about to list. For those who are called, so one, called, according to his purpose for redemption, those he foreknew, and also predestined to be conformed into his image, or into the image of his son, in order that he might be the firstborn among many brothers. All right, so this is what I mean. I think when he says, we know that all these things work together for good, the things that are working together for good are the calling, the foreknowing, and the predestining, and the conforming to the image of his son. This is what works together for good. Everything God is doing with you, in other words, is working together for your good. And here's the big things that he's doing for you. First of all, he's foreknowing you, then he's calling you, then he's predestining you, or something like this. And then he's ultimately transforming you into the image of his son. And that's good. That's what's working together for good. That, I believe, is the sense of the passage in its context. So, what does all that mean? That was a lot of big words. Big concepts, anyway. Not such big words. It says, all these things, these following things, work together for good for those who are called. Now, what does called mean? I mean, called is one of those Christian words, you know, that you hear. It's a ministry word. Like, were you called? Did you have a calling? Did you feel called? You know, I just felt called to, you know, that sort of thing. It's like, and people, those are one of the words, those are sort of buzzwords that people don't understand outside of our circles, you know. So kind of when you have a word like that, sometimes it's useful to just stop and say, what do I mean by that word? What do I mean? Called like Moses, Moses, you know, Vayikra, and he called to Moses, and the Lord called to Moses from inside the tent of meeting, and said, Moses, like that. That's a calling. You know, you see it when you get to Mount Sinai. It says Hashem called to Moses, come up here, you know. There's like all this call and response going on and this conversation between God and Moses. That's part of it. But I think the way that Paul is using it goes right back to, he already defined what he means by this in the very beginning of the epistle. When he addressed this epistle, he addressed it to those who are called by God to belong to Yeshua the Messiah. That's Romans 1:6. And called to be saints, Romans 1:7. So he defines his own terminology. Called to belong to Yeshua, called to be righteous. To be saints, of course, means to be righteous. You knew that. Because a saint is just the English way of saying tzaddik, a righteous person. So called to belong to Yeshua and called to be tzaddikim. That's what it means to be called. I like it. Called to belong to Yeshua and called to be righteous. And he says, those who are called, all things are working together, for those who are called to belong to Yeshua and to be righteous, according to his purpose of redemption. That's my adding. I'm adding of redemption. Because I think Paul assumes you know what the purpose is. He's been talking about it for the whole chapter. This redemption, this transformation, the resurrection, the recreation. Not just the redemption from the nations, not just the redemption of the exiles of Israel, but the redemption of the whole world back to this Edenic state. So, called according to his purpose. And what's his purpose? To redeem the world. And this is what's kind of great about Hashem, you know, and his wanting to redeem the world and making a big drama out of it that lasts all of human history. Because he could have just folded it up. He didn't have to redeem it. I mean, we could be universe number 5 billion, you know, or whatever. That's like, you know, like the scene where the writer types, you know, it was a dark and stormy night. And takes the paper out, crumples it up, throws it on the floor, and the camera moves, and you see the, like, there's a pile of these crumpled up papers, you know. We could be that. He could have done it like that. He didn't have to redeem this creation. It could have been like, you know, the putting the neshama in the monkey, bad idea. Not going to try that again, you know, and done something else. But instead, he's sticking with this. He's sticking with this, and that's his purpose, Paul says. It's his purpose with us is redemption. This, I'm going to make this work. We're going to make this work. So he says, for those he foreknew, he also predestined. Now, of course, we're into the Calvinist verses now. And I'm really not, I'm not going to, it's like no secret. I'm not a Calvinist. You know, no big secret there. I don't buy it. I don't understand how anyone who has a high view of Judaism could possibly be a Calvinist. I mean, because it's so antithetical to the basic fundamentals of Judaism, which is that God rewards righteousness and punishes sin, and everything runs through that process. Everything runs through that filter. And so if there's not a choice, the whole thing is a farce. You know? So, I'm not a Calvinist. No secret whatsoever. I think that this language that fuels this debate and this whole theological rigmarole has been obviously lifted from Romans. I mean, this is clearly, you know, the center of the ideology. But, you know, I just don't read it that way. On the other hand, there's another level. There's the ultra mystical level of Jewish thought, which you could say is very Calvinist. On the ultra mystical level, there is a level in which Hashem sits outside of it all. And, you know, everything, you know, he's got the whole universe in his hands, and nothing happens randomly or by chance. There is no chance. This is a different level, and it's not the level we're on. We're here in this world, and the scriptures are interfacing with us here in this world. That's the point of the word becoming flesh and the word becoming scroll, is that, so we're down here, we should be working on this level. So maybe John Calvin got it right, but if he got it right, he got it right only outside of the revealed universe, which is of no use to anybody inside the revealed universe. So, all right. I hope that's all clear now. I hope I've been able to clear that up for you. Right? yeah. You know,
so we still don't know what foreign Node is.
Oh, well, we're going to get for Node. Yeah, we're going to get for Node now.
Mm-hmm. I thought that was the joke.
No. Here's my suggestion. You can read it right on the sheet. I'm suggesting that Paul's still talking about the soul, as he was a few verses earlier, is talking about Hashem using the spirit and the spirit translating for the spirit and that sort of thing. I'm suggesting that what he foreknew is in reference to the Pharisaic belief that Hashem foreknows every soul, every neshama. And by foreknowing would mean knowing before the neshama became what was conceived in or before the human being was conceived and the neshama entered the human body. I'll show you some support for this idea in a moment. And then I'm understanding the words, he also predestined, and I'm understanding that along the same lines of Jewish mysticism that teaches that God gives every neshama a mission. Every soul that's put into a human being has accepted God's mission, in fact. And God said, I'm going to give you a mission. Here's your mission. I want you to go. I want you to go become, indwell this human being, this human creature, who's made in my image, and I want you to join with this human creature and experience life in the material world. Experience corporeality, physicality. And I want you to rise above it. And then elevate that animal, elevate that creature to our level of spiritual existence. And this, so in one way or another, this is the mission of every soul. Now, every soul has its own unique version of that mission, the things that the soul needs to accomplish in this world, and so forth. This is just basic Jewish mysticism. So this is how I'm understanding it. For those souls, I guess you could say, those neshamot that he foreknew, those spirits that he foreknew in the spiritual state of pre-existence of the neshama, he also predestined, that is to say, he assigned them with a mission to be conformed to the image of his son. Here's the mission that they're on. To be conformed to the image of his son, that is, the divine man, as mentioned in Romans 5:14, the heavenly Adam. And this is to take place ultimately through means of the resurrection. In order that he, that is Yeshua, might be the firstborn son of God among many brothers, among many sons and daughters of God. That's the soul's mission that it's been predestined for. That it's been. Now, whether or not the soul is going to be successful in this mission or not remains, to be, that's the adventure. That's the whole drama. Right? But what Paul's excited about is that in the gospel, in this gospel message, here's how success can happen. Here's how this can work. And it turns out it's not on the soul itself to attain this thing, but it's the Son of God, the Messiah has accomplished this deliverance. So now, before we go on with that thought, I'm going to give you my support for this reading. You can go over to Jeremiah. Chapter 1. And this is some of the places where this mystical interpretation is derived from in the first place, of the soul descending into the body and the soul being foreknown and that sort of thing. So Hashem is having a conversation with Jeremiah. The first thing he says to him, as a prophet, very first thing Jeremiah hears when he realizes, I'm hearing voices. The very first thing he hears is God saying to him, and this is Jeremiah 1:5, before I formed you in the womb, and understand that before I formed you in the womb, then it is his conception and such. He says, before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. Well, what is that? That's being foreknown. Right? And before you were born, I consecrated you, which is this calling type of thing. Now listen, he's been predestined too. I have appointed you to be a prophet to the nations. Or to the nations, yeah. So he's foreknown him, he's called him, and he's predestined him. He has a destiny. Do you hear the word destiny is in predestined, right? So it's not as if he said, and I predestined you to go to hell, or I predestined you to go to heaven when you die. You know, that's not really, you know, there's a different, we're talking about the mission of the soul in the body. That's how I'm reading it. Okay. Another example, if we go over to Isaiah 49, have the same conversation this time with the servant of the Lord. This is with the soul of Messiah, the neshama of Yeshua, is in this conversation. Listen to me, O islands, and pay attention, you peoples from afar. Hashem called me from the womb. Oh, he's been called. Do you see this? From the body of my mother, he named me. So he was in this way called, foreknown. In the shadow of his hand, he has concealed me. He has made me a select arrow. He has hidden me in his quiver. He said, you are my servant, Israel, in whom I will show my glory. But I said, I have toiled in vain. I have spent my strength for nothing and vanity. Yet surely the justice due me is with Hashem, and my reward with my God. This is a reference to the suffering of Messiah. And now, says Hashem, who formed me from the womb to be his servant. See, he's predestined to be his servant. To bring Jacob back so that Israel might be gathered to him. For I'm honored in the sight of the Lord. And as you know the passage, right? It goes on where Hashem says, you know, I think it's too small of a thing. You can keep reading it, but he says, I think it's too small of a thing. What I was originally thinking was that I was just going to have you redeem the tribes of Israel and the exiles of Israel and redeem the nation. But now I'm starting to think that we should redeem the whole world. What do you think? This is the conversation that he has. And in this conversation, you know, he's foreknowing the Messiah. He's calling him. He's assigning him a destiny. Okay. That's where I'm getting it from, these passages. So it goes on in verse 30. And those whom he predestined for the mission of being conformed to the image of his son, he also called, and those whom he called, he also justified. And when he says justified, that means declared righteous, exonerated in the court of judgment, which is Rosh Hashanah talk. Now we're talking Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. You know, when we're standing before the throne of justice, the throne of mercy, and the books are open, and there's a book of the righteous, it's also called the book of the life, and there's a book of the wicked, that's also called the book of death, and then there's the book of everybody in between, and their names have to be ported from the book of in between into either the book of the righteous, even though they probably weren't completely righteous, or the book of death, even though they probably weren't completely wicked, but everybody's name has to end up in one of the two books. You start with three books, but you can only have two books by the time you come to Yom Kippur. That's the whole high holiday thing. That's a high holiday idea. And so when Paul says, uses the term justified, he has this in view, this Jewish idea of judgment, three books down to two books. And justified means getting in the book of the righteous. It doesn't mean you are a complete and holy tzaddik. If you were, then you're already in the book of the righteous, you know. But you don't need to be justified. But to be justified is to be a sinner who is here in the book of the in-between, and you got moved into the book of the righteous. How does that happen? Well, you know, God's merciful is how it happens. God has grace on sinners. This is how it happens. And according to Paul, it happens through the favor that God found in his son, Yeshua, and that favor being shared with us, right? Okay. So in other words, justified means being made righteous, declared righteous, being declared righteous. To put it in the language of the English Standard Version we're reading, to be declared a saint. The Book of Life, the Book of the Righteous, could also be called the Book of the Saints. Okay? What's the opposite of a saint? I mean, what would the Book of the Wicked be in that same kind of language? Saints. Yeah, I know, but let's... Saints and sinners, you know, I guess, right? Saints and sinners. But that doesn't really work since a lot of the saints are sinners. I don't know. Damned. Yeah. Okay.
Quick question.
Yes.
So, the